This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to I'm Absolutely Fine, the podcast from the Midult that looks at all the glamour and indignity of being a grown-up.
Hey everybody, how are you feeling? Do you feel like a fully functioning human woman? Or do you feel like a collapsed sofa?
If the stuffing has been knocked out of you by, well, everything, it might be time to talk about the gut microbiome. Go on, let's. I know it's not sexy repartee, but it's a conversation worth having because it affects, well, everything. Bear with me briefly. Your gut microbiome is a vast ecosystem with bacteria as diverse as the Amazon rainforest. They break down food and help your body to detoxify. They support the immune system. They can affect energy and weight, as well as mental health.
But along with all the bacteria lurk yeasts, fungi and viruses, good guys and bad guys. And research has now shown that the composition of the gut microbiome can change with dietary intervention, stress levels and quality of sleep. Scientists are increasingly treating the gut as its own organ, which is why we are delighted that this podcast is brought to you by Simprove again.
Let me tell you a story. Long before Simprove approached us to sponsor the podcast, I had started swigging it every morning and felt a difference within weeks. It's a water-based supplement that carries live and active bacteria that can endure the incredible journey from mouth to gut in order to start to multiply and produce food for the bugs we already have. Don't even get me started on the gut-brain connection.
Now, I've now been using it for 6 months and I can't get enough of the stuff. Hair, mood, skin, digestion, it's all happening more as it should, as it used to.
Everybody who knows about this stuff knows that Simprove is the best of its kind. You can sign up for a 12-week introductory program, and here's your code for a 15% discount, MIDULT15 at simprove.com. Simprove, follow your gut feeling. Hi everybody, I'm Annabelle and I'm absolutely fine, but last night I fell asleep in the bath and I didn't just sort of go drowsy in the bath. I mean, I absolutely passed out for probably half an hour.
Jesus.
I mean, my bath is so hot you could poach a chicken in one, and by the time I woke up, the water was cold.
But that's completely terrifying, Annabelle.
Well, it's depressing for so many reasons. Firstly, because it's like proper old codger territory.
Oh, God.
And secondly, because it's actually dangerous.
Like, really
So my
dangerous.
Insomnia is going to kill me. Not just because of all those awful newspaper articles you read going, how to be healthier, how to extend your life, make sure you get 7 hours of sleep a night. Well, how? Well, not, I'm now so exhausted that I'm risking my life by having a bath.
God, it's the front line of life right now, isn't it?
I know.
I can't believe it. Well, I'm
How
Emily.
Are you?
Well, I'm Emily and I'm absolutely fine. But I opened my knicker drawer this morning and I just thought, I don't have any new knickers. In fact, all my knickers are really old, saggy and baggy. And I don't know if I mind. That's the thing about these things.
Usually we're in a kind of knicker cycle, aren't we? Where you've got knickers, you know, that are sort of 15 years old. Then you've got new ones, which are probably just a multi-pack that are 18 months old, but their elastic is still in some way functional.
And not grey or whatever.
And they're not grey. But actually, you've given up on your knicker game, haven't you?
I have, slightly. And I had a rootle around and I thought, I've got knickers in my drawer that are at least 13, 14 years old. Is that okay?
No.
Steph is shocked.
I've literally, me and my partner, we did a cull of old knickers recently, which was quite hard, but I was like, how can we possibly have some knickers here that we've had forever?
But how old were the oldest knickers that you had?
Probably 5 years would be my max, I think.
She's a classy lady.
She's so classy. Okay, this is our classy guest.
There was a time in our lives, wasn't there, and when you would always have like a pair of sexy knickers in case you needed them.
Yeah.
And now,
No, I do have that pair of sexy knickers, and it's a pair of Agent Profond knickers that honestly would probably only go up my thigh now and cover, like,
hang off your little toe.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But don't you think when you buy new knickers, though, the only problem with this theory I have is that I then don't wear them for ages because I think I'm going to keep them for good.
Yes,
save them for best.
A bit like sexy knickers. Yes. I'm like, I'm going to keep them for good. I'll just go back to my haggard looking ones for now.
And also the thing about sexy knickers is that proper sexy knickers are in no way suitable for living your life and being out in the world because they just don't work in a practical way. So, you know, now that we're all grown up women, there's no occasion to really wear them.
But also now that we are all in elastic trousers, not so much our guest, who I will introduce in a second, I promise, but we're in the flow now. So
cart before the horse.
Yes, exactly.
Knickers before the introduction.
Always, let's just talk about knickers. But is that, you know, when you're wearing elasticated, like, you know, sort of tracksuit bottoms all the time, you can't really have lacy knickers underneath.
I mean, imagine having a pair of sort of French made monstrosity fluffy things underneath that. You'd look really bizarre, like you're wearing a nappy.
Yeah.
Have you never had that time, though, where you run out of your usual knickers and you have to wear the sexy ones and then you're just constantly picking them out of your arse for the whole
Once in a blue moon when I'm behind on the laundry, I'll suddenly think, fucking hell, I'm going to have to wear a G-string today.
Yeah.
Get out the pseudocreme.
Exactly. Right. Prepare, dial a thrush. Let's go. Anyway, there's no more time for knickers because we have a force of nature in our midst. Now, maybe you started needlepointing during lockdown or baked a dodgy sourdough loaf or two. But if you're Steph McGovern, you started a whole television show from your front room.
I mean, stop it.
And had a baby. Anyway, moving on. In fact, Steph's packed lunch was just nominated for a BAFTA.
Hooray!
By the way, she finished recording today's show 15 minutes ago and now she is here. I mean, come on, talk about powerhouse. Hello, Steph. How are you?
I am absolutely fine, but I am sleep deprived. Mainly because of so many of us do trying to juggle having a child and a job.
Oh, I mean, the struggle is real.
The juggle is real. It is a nightmare. And how bad is your sleep?
Well, I don't know about you, but my, obviously your priorities change, don't they, when you have a kid, and the things you worry about change. So now I find it quite hard to get to sleep at night when I can, because I'm constantly thinking something catastrophic is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, you really believe that there's a lion at the mouth of the cave and that you have to stay, you have to keep one eye open in case it pounces.
Yeah, totally. And because, you know, we've all been through those times where you have the phase where they're awake all the time and then they sleep for a bit, then they start nursery and they come back with every bug known to man. And then they keep you up again and you just like, you don't know which night you're ever going to get, do you, when you go to bed? You just know, you don't know what it's going to be that night. So therefore, when I'm about to go to sleep, I'm just like, right, this is going to be the night she wakes up at 12. So how am I going to manage it? And then before you know it, it's 12 because I've been sat thinking, how am I going to manage it for the next
Or you've gone to sleep and then you wake up at 12 thinking, she's not screaming. Is she breathing?
Yeah.
I mean, actually, am I right in thinking that you got sort of a version of night terrors during lockdown when your baby was very small? What happened?
Yeah. So these are something I've had all my life, actually, which I think is how, like, stress manifests in me. So it manifests in two ways, night terrors and IBS. But the night terror stuff is, I think it partly comes from my job of, I interview people where extreme things have happened to them, you know, like extreme tragedy or, you know, horrific diseases or whatever else. And therefore, I've got all the worst case scenarios of everything in my head. And so at night, I just imagine mad things happening and I've woken up in different rooms or I've woken up like, you know, it's believing something that isn't there. And it does kind of, you know, kind of go through a peaks and troughs depending on what's going on in my life. So when I had my little girl, it was off the scale. Like, I was convinced that she was not going to be alive every time I looked in the cot, or, you know, the house was going to catch fire. Like, I wouldn't let my partner put the dishwasher on at night because I'd interviewed someone who's, when I was doing Watchdog, whose dishwasher had set the house on fire in the night.
Thank you for telling me that.
I'm really sorry. But
that's it. God, that's rude.
But also, that's not only going to disrupt your sleep, is it? It's going to disrupt, I mean, your subconscious is clearly a sort of, you know, a sort of pulsating jungle of madness. And so, I mean, as all of us are, but if it rises to the surface, it's going to disrupt your emotional life throughout the day, presumably.
Yeah, well, weirdly or not, I think this is the thing with night terrors. They don't then impact your day, so I don't then necessarily catastrophize during the day. I just get on with my job, and I'm quite good at being distracted, and I don't worry about my daughter all day while I'm at work. I quite easily forget about her, to be honest. But it's just when I'm back in that kind of... I'm better in a mad, busy phase than I am in a rested position, then I just start thinking the worst. So
I mean, it's a bit like, you know, some people say that you're meant to have a worry window in the day where you're allowed to, for 20 minutes, worry about everything. Literally think about worst case scenario about everything. And maybe you do that when you're asleep.
Yeah.
And then it's sort of dealt with.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So is that part of the reason that you started this show during lockdown? Because you needed some busy.
Well, do you know, it's funny you should say that, because all of my mates were like, there's no way you're going to do maternity leave and all this. And I was like, no, I am. I'm going to really take my time. And, you know, then Channel 4 approached me about doing a show and from Leeds. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. But still, it wasn't going to launch until my daughter would have been about 8 months or something. And then they said, when the pandemic hit, listen, this is probably not going to be able to launch then because we can't get the studio finished. And I was like, I want to be part of this, though. Still, I still want to do something. Let's do it from my house. And I you know, I'm very private. I don't, you know, you wouldn't see my spreads in my kitchen in OK Magazine, mainly because it's a mess. But I, you know, I don't do all that. And I don't, you know, talk about who my partner or child are because I just want them to be private. So it's quite weird for me to do that, to say, let's do it from my house. But it's because everyone was having to work in a different way. Suddenly everyone was broadcasting from their home. Okay, slightly different. I was doing it on national telly, but we were all doing Zooms or Microsoft Teams or whatever it was. And everyone was suddenly being invited into your home. Your boss was suddenly seeing your wallpaper and your bookshelf. All of us thought about what our backdrop would be on meetings. And so I kind of wanted to be part of that. I didn't want to miss, you know, being part of like the people trying to give you a bit of a laugh for an hour every day at lunchtime. So, and I love the kind of thrill of that. Can we do it or not? Are we actually going to stay on air? Is my internet connection going to let us broadcast? Because we were relying on my just home internet to broadcast the show. So it was like, you know, and who's going to knock on the door or whatever else? Not many people in a lockdown, obviously.
But, no, but lots of DPD drivers or exactly. Those, all those yodel bastards or whoever, like just chucking stuff at you. Exactly. Yeah. How funny. I love the idea that you were so absolutely sure that you couldn't do maternity leave that you'd invite an entire like broadcast.
Nation. You invite the nation into your front room.
Yeah.
I mean, but
I know.
But I do think that, I agree, I think that the whole new way of working is so fantastic. And for a broadcaster, that's a veteran broadcaster like you, it must have been so exciting to kind of like trial the new ways and to kind of get it done.
Yeah
it was. And that was the thing, like there was nobody else doing it. Like to begin with, there wasn't anyone else doing a live show every day. Like people were doing pre-recorded stuff from their home, but there wasn't like a live show for that long with that format. There was news, people started doing news from home and things. So that was dead exciting. And, you know, it was great because then the publicity was, I was part of like lots of different magazine interviews about it. And that was all really good for the show. So, and it also was a really good way of trying stuff out because Channel 4 hadn't had a live lunchtime show on weekdays for, I think it's something like 20 years, which was Mel and Sue's Light Lunch.
Yes, I should say, before we started recording, we were saying, well, we used to be huge fans of Mel and Sue's Light Lunch, and Steph was saying it was kind of an inspiration.
Yeah,
totally. We used to watch it at university, so I can't believe it's 20 years old. Oh, God.
Well, you're clearly a hopeless adrenaline junkie. I mean, I can't believe that you took that on. And so it's 100 minutes every day, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And the thing that astounded Emily and me was that it's news responsive. So you can in no way really sit on your laurels and just discuss flower arranging, can you?
No, I mean, we do a bit of that, though. So, like, you know, we'll have Linda Barker in doing the dried flower craft displays or whatever. But I think the good thing is it's the light and shade. So what we've created is like a family of people, because it's not all about me. Yeah, my name's on it. But for me, it's about the people who are in the room with me. So we've got a family of former politicians, you know, current presenters, comedians, that type of thing. And then we have the gang that we call the Lunchmates, who are our, you know, also part of the family, who have got normal jobs as well. And they will come in and be part of the show. And so it's just created this place where we can respond to things because we've all got different views on stuff, but it's very inclusive. Like, I don't want people arguing on the show. Make your point, but I hate that where people are butted up against each other. Are you the yes? Are you the no? Right, we want 5 minutes of you having a go at each other.
When the producers are producing them to be combative, right? And so what you have is really the ideal Sunday lunch. You've got a family, different ages, different everything. Actually being nice to each other about having a conversation.
A good vox pop, don't you? And sort of that sort of collaborative conversation that helps to kind of sort of get the sort of temperature of the nation, but at the same time, all the different views, but show that you can hold all these opinions at the same time, right? I mean, surely that's got to be the way forward, because I feel like we're in the world right now, she says, grandly in her saggy knickers, there's so much that everybody has to, can only hold one position at once.
And you can't change your mind.
And you just think, oh my God, it's absolutely exhausting. And of course, nothing can move forward if we all stick to our,
And that I liken us to a dysfunctional family. Like, you're not going to necessarily like all of us, but you will find your person that who you're a bit like out of all of us, because there's such a mix. And then, for example, if we're talking about something like a footballer coming out as being gay, so in our group of people, we've got a boxer in the family, Carl Frampton, talking about how difficult it is to come out in boxing if you're gay. John Waite, who's part of the family, who was the first male gay couple on Strictly. We've got, some of our lunch mates about how in their community and their culture, the opposition they've faced. And then we've got like Baroness Saida Varsi, who voted against gay marriage and things back in the day, and now has apologised for all of that. And, we're like, everyone is a melting pot, and we can be annoyed at Saida for voting against it, but equally she's now learnt from us and learnt from her life experiences, and that is okay for her to change her mind. And that, I think you're right. I think it's, unless you've done some heinous crimes, I think people should be allowed to intellectually change their opinion about things as you learn more.
It's not just okay for her to change her mind. It's brilliant that she's changed her mind. And it's something that should sort of be applauded, So in a way, there's tolerance, isn't there, operating
across. Yeah, there is. And we all learn from each other, because Saeed is Muslim. She's taught us about loads of things that have been misconstrued in her community about how women are treated and things like that. So it's a learning curve for all of us, which is nice, but mainly we have a laugh as well. Like, we're not taking ourselves too seriously. So,
can we just talk a little bit about your journey?
My journey?
Your incredible
from
journey.
Where to where?
Well, this is the thing. From an Irish dancing engineer who did work experience on Tomorrow's World, through to the, a senior business correspondent at the BBC, through to your own show. I mean, that's quite multicoloured, isn't it? And also, I remember reading, I think this was a while ago, I mean, I could say 5 years, but it could be any point from, between yesterday and 25 years ago, you talking about what it was like to be on telly with a Northern accent.
And then that's the thing that still comes up a lot, annoyingly, because you think we would have moved on just as much as you would hope a footballer coming out as gay wouldn't be a shock.
I know.
Well done, lad, by the way, don't you think?
Yeah, I know.
17 and so brave.
So brave,
yeah.
Anyway.
No, he's an amazing lad, Jake. I suppose to give the context to me, I'm an only child, and I think I have always been someone who has wanted to please everyone and have a go at everything. I would say I'm quite a risk taker, and I grew up in an environment, like particularly at my school, where it was a tough place. But, it was a real mix of backgrounds in my class and things, but we were all taught that no one is better than you. No one is worse than you either, but no one's better than you. And there's nothing you can't achieve in terms of, you might not win the X Factor if you can't sing, but you might be the producer of the X Factor and there's nothing to stop you being that. Or you if you're not a great footballer, but you might be the chief exec of the club. So we were really had our minds broadened to the possibilities of careers and things. And I think that is what's got me where I am. There was a real connection between our school and industry and jobs, because it was full of kids from really tough homes.
And was this Middlesbrough?
This is Middlesbrough. So I think, and if you look at the people I grew up with, they've all done really well for themselves. And I think that's because we were given this confidence that often, you're not given in schools. Not all schools, there's loads of schools that do that. But I mean, particularly if you're in a tough part, a deprived area, you can sometimes feel like there isn't the ambition there. So the school just really like pushed me into loads of things. So I was forever entering competitions, like engineering competitions, winning little holidays to Spain. And because we were the poor kids, we were always had money thrown at us through different schemes. Like I remember winning something where I had to go around to this rich person's house in Maida Vale and be introduced to them as, oh, look, you know, I had to meet this bloke's kids because he just paid for me to do this big university thing. And I had to meet these kids and they were like, you know, look, these are the type of people we help. And I remember sitting there howling, thinking, God, you think I've had a really hard life? And I haven't. I've had an amazing life. I don't have servants, but I don't need them. And so,
I love the idea that you're like wheeled out, like, here you go.
Yeah, yeah. It was so funny.
This is what a poor kid looks like. Yeah, here you go. Yeah. Wheel back to me. That's just unbelievable. Yeah. My God.
Yeah, but he wasn't being like, it taught me a lot about ignorance as well, though, I think. And that's, you know, set me well in my career when I've had to interview politicians and things like that. But my school was all into industry and I was really into engineering. I saw there was a lot of openings for women in engineering because they were desperate to get more in, and there was a lot of money and scholarships and schemes, and so I went for all of them and I loved it. And then I got asked to go and be a guest on a show for the BBC because I'd just won a big award to go and talk about being a woman in science and engineering. And I just loved it. I was in the BBC building and I was like, oh my God, I want to work here. Like, this is where Live and Kicking comes from. This is where they do Children in Need.
Yes.
Like,
oh my God.
So that's it. I worked my way through the ranks. I started off answering the phones at the BBC while I was kind of still doing the engineering stuff, and then just, you know, went as a researcher and a producer, and then got asked to try out on the radio, and that went well, and then ended up on the telly. So yeah, I think it's just every opportunity that's been thrown at me, I've literally just gone, yeah, okay, I'm gonna have a go, even though sometimes I've been really nervous about it and it's quite intimidating.
But I mean, you know, the stress of producing this show 5 days a week, how do you cope with that? Do you get anxiety? Do you?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, coming back to what I was saying earlier, it does manifest in two ways. And one is the sleep stuff, but also like IBS. Like I've struggled with IBS most of my life. And it's only like recently that I've managed to, in the last kind of 18 months, that I've managed to get on top of it. So I would have it where I would be, have massive stomach cramps and then have to leg it to the loo. And, you know, there've been times where I've literally nearly shit myself on telly.
Yeah.
And so you know, that's always just something. And do you know, it's weird. I've talked to so many people since I've been open about it. So many people tell me that they have that as well. And you just would never guess it. So like, and I ended up doing a program with Hugh Fernie Whittenstall about gut health. And I got my, sorry, this is really a lot, but I got like my poo analysed.
No, it's fascinating. And, one in five people have IBS or something. Oh,
yeah, I mean, one in five have,
yes,
yeah,
and you don't realise A, how painful it is, and B, how scary it is, that you might have an actual disaster.
Yeah.
Oh, honestly, there's so many times when I've really panicked. But I
what did your poo have to say?
Yeah, so my poo, this is terrible, my poo came back and it was in the worst third of the population in terms of my diversity of my poo. So basically I was like, I had very little bacteria, like good healthy gut stuff in there. So I was like, oh my God, this is, what am I going to do about it? And so I basically just changed my routine in a way that's made a huge difference. So for example, one of the things I do, and one of the people I work with now, is Simproof. They have like a gut friendly little shot that you do in the morning, and it's just full of like good bacteria, so that helps with the diversity in your gut health. And so I have that, but I also do intermittent fasting as well, where I'll only have food between 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. Now, you can do it whatever time works for you, but basically you only eat for 8 hours a day, and then the rest of the time, and I do that 5 days a week, weekends out the window.
I mean,
weekends
that's normal, that's a diet hack as well, isn't it?
When you when you say, do you mean you can only eat, you don't eat all day?
No, you eat for 8 hours and you don't eat for 16.
But you only eat in between those hours.
Yes.
You don't eat like for 8 hours.
I don't permanently graze whilst
on
telly.
I was going to say, because I've definitely watched you on television and you're not
eating. You could definitely eat bread for 8 hours solid.
I could definitely graze for 8 hours solid. Yeah. I feel like that would be my, anyway, sorry. Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah,
that's so
that, and that, I honestly, like, it's really interesting because I'm always a bit like, I think I've just got a bit of IBS, and you know, it's onions, it's this, it's that. I've always blamed other things. And then from doing the Simprove and doing the intermittent fasting, and then I've tried to put more things in my diet, like kimchi and sauerkraut, which are all a bit random and a bit weird to get used to, and kombucha, those types of things, just incorporating them a bit into my diet has made like such a massive difference, to the point now where I very rarely get IBS now, like, you know, because my gut health is so much better. I've had it analysed since, and I'm now in the top third of the population.
Congratulations, it's a win.
And now the bloating's gone as well. So loads of people have been saying to me, how have you lost weight? What's happening with your weight? I honestly haven't been trying to lose weight because, yes, of course, I think about weight, but that wasn't the reason for this. It was absolutely how debilitating it was having IBS and how bad it had got, particularly after having had my baby, because I'd got my gut health a bit better before I was pregnant, and then pregnancy totally threw it out the window because I had such bad pregnancy sickness. So then when I had her and I was starting again, it was just terrible. And I thought, I can't do a live show where I'm halfway through an interview thinking I might have to run out and go to the loo, because that is what would happen to me. I'd be like absolutely like clenching my butt cheeks together.
Sometimes you really have to be pushed to the point where disaster is very possible before you do anything, don't you? Because we find ourselves getting completely resigned to these chronic conditions that are painful, and whether it's IBS, whether it's insomnia, whether it's menopause, and you just think, you know, oh well, because you're so ground down by it that you don't make these changes, these relatively small changes that you've made that have made this phenomenal difference.
Because they are sustainable as well. Because I have been one of those people in the past who's gone, right, it's the flipping TV awards coming up, I'm just going to eat dust for 3 weeks or whatever. And it's that, none of that is sustainable. But this has been, because I've just adapted it into my life, and it's nothing major. I still, you know, I still drink wine at the weekends. I still, and occasionally during the week. I'm not like eating just salads all day, every day or anything. I'm still, because, you know, I get to eat all the lovely food on the show. Today it was like a passion fruit cake that John had made. But I just know today I'll stop eating at 7 p.m. and I won't start again until 11 a.m. And I'll have my little shot of Simprove. I'll wait 10 minutes and then I'll have my, you know, whatever it is that I'm going to have, my little chicken teriyaki bowl. Funnily enough, I don't drink tea or coffee. Which I think
you're a northerner. You're meant to drink tea with every meal.
Yeah, I know. I'm the black sheep of the family, I think.
Do they actually speak to you? Yes. No.
Well, but they'll be speaking to you now, because I mean, fucking BAFTA, Steph.
Oh, I know. Honestly, do you know when I got that email to say I'd been nominated? I was on the train, and weirdly, I was just coming back from the Royal Television Society Awards, where we'd been up for one there, and I was already hungover and thinking, wow, my life's amazing. And then I got this email, and I was like, no, that's, what's this? Is this BIFTA? BUFTA? What's this? And then I rang our exec and was like, is this, what is this? And they were like, BAFTA! And I was like, oh, because, you know, when we started out as well, like, I mean, we are the underdogs. And when we started out, we got so much like, oh, you know, why are Channel 4 doing this, blah, blah, blah. And then
What were they saying? Did they think that it wasn't, you know, appropriate for Channel 4? Or did they think it was a saturated time slot? Were the objections?
It's just when you first launch a new show, inevitably, you're breaking into, particularly in daytime, you're breaking into a market that has been the same for 25 years. So you're like trying to slowly chip away at it. And the great thing, Channel 4 were like, this is going to take a while to like get where we need it to be. We're going to give you that time. But at the beginning, don't panic when people say whatever about viewing figures or whatever else. It's like, just hold your nerve and don't look at it and carry on. So that's what was great.
I mean, it's interesting, having been a BBC correspondent, that you have gone from having these difficult and complicated discussions with, you know, difficult and complicated people, to applying that experience to a different kind of conversation.
Yeah. And I think, well, your conversations just evolve through life anyway, don't they? Like, as adults, you just, you know, how I've changed over the last decade, my conversations have changed naturally anyway. And I feel like I listen a lot more now than I ever would in the past. And I'm not fighting for like news lines like I was in the past. Now I'm taking my time to go, okay, tell me what you think about these things. I'm not going to chip in with a, well, what are you doing about blah, 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 which I perhaps would have done in the past to try and get that news line that then, you know, ends up in the papers or whatever else. But now it's more like, more considered, which is a really nice place to be at. And I enjoy the interviews a lot more because I feel like I'm just genuinely asking the questions I'd want to ask and that I think the listeners and viewers might want to ask as well.
Wisdom, Steph, you're becoming a grand dame of national television.
I don't know about that.
Which is why
I'm here for now.
Which is why I want to ask you about Irish dancing.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love that. Is that something you did as a child? Because we were watching a clip earlier of you doing kind of sensational Irish dancing on telly.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of those. Loads of people have asked me whether my head's been CGI'd onto that body. But it is genuinely my legs. No, I did it again, you know, as an only child. I was just into everything. And Irish dancing was just something that really caught my attention as a kid. And it was before Riverdance, actually, and Lord of the Dance. So it wasn't popular, it was a bit weird, but I just loved it. And I turned out, because I've got quite loose ankles, who knew?
That's a good thing, is it?
It is. Yeah, being like to loose morals. Your ankles.
Yeah. Oh, you flap your feet around and your funny loose flabberty ankles.
So I loved it. And actually, again, that taught me a lot about, it's weird in dancing, there isn't the class divides in many other sectors, because I never knew what any of the kids I was competing against parents did, or whether they had money or not. Like, it was irrelevant, or whether what jobs the dance teachers had and things, because it was just all about this bubble of who's a good dancer or not, which was great, because then I was meeting people from all over the world who were dancing, and weirdly, you know, like, some of them are now in my life in other ways. So one of the makeup artists was someone I used to compete against when I was a kid dancing, but she's from Manchester and obviously I'm from Middlesbrough, but we were in the same age group. So there's just random stuff like that. Or like Angela Scanlon, the presenter, her and I, we've worked out, must have competed against each other at some point so in dancing. Funny.
It's like the sort of Illuminati.
I know, maybe.
Yeah, secret ring of Irish dancers. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have a handshake, you have a foot shake or something.
Yeah. You're secretly radicalising us all to become Irish dancers through the screen.
We are.
Does that mean you're going to do Strictly?
I don't, and I'll never say never to Strictly, but it's definitely not the right time at the moment, because if I do it, I'd want to absolutely throw myself into it. And I think having a little toddler is not the time, because I'd miss her too much, and I'd be like then, you know, halfy, feeling like I'm not being a good enough mum and I'm not being a good enough dancer. And I've still got my show to do every day. So I'm not saying I won't do it, but in the times I've been asked so far, it's just not been right with either being pregnant or having a little bit, just, you know.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do it pregnant.
No, I don't think you'd be allowed either.
Pregnant with IVF. I mean, literally anything could happen.
Yeah. Projectile vomiting and shitting herself during a salsa.
And on that note, Steph, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thank you. You've
really cheered us up.
It's what a joy. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Steph.
Bye.
This podcast was bravely brought to you by Simprove. You can sign up for a 12-week introductory program, and here's your code for a 15% discount, MIDULT15 at simprove.com.
You've been listening to Annabel Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The MIDULT. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe.